The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Ace.
Yo.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
How's the weather out there in Arizona?
Fucking hot. It's about 115 right now. Yeah.
Well, at least that's...
I'm sorry, it's 112.
Big difference there, 3 degrees.
Yeah, exactly. 3 degrees, right?
It's at least it's dry heat, though.
It doesn't matter, man. I mean, it's horrible right now. I mean, it really is. We got our air on 78 in the house, and it pumps all day long.
Wow.
You know, it's just it's brutal. It's down to about maybe 99 at night.
Oof.
But, yeah, there's no humidity like, you know, back east. But it's still 114, 113, still nasty.
It's brutal, yeah.
We get a little humidity, about 20% the other day, and it was pretty bad.
All right, so I guess we can get started if you're ready.
Cool.
Listen to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, another cult classic band from the 80s underground as we speak with vocalist and lyricist Ace Still from Black and Doom pioneers Goat Lord and Doom Snake Cult on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Third Eye Cinema, no, I've been a huge fan and supporter of the metal underground from its earliest days back in the mid-80s, and have brought such folks as Exhumer, Dream Death, Whiplash, and Bloodfeast on air over the course of the past year. In continuing with that noble tradition, tonight we feature a rare interview with one of the men behind no less than two bands whose reputation has grown considerably over the intervening years. Tonight we plumb the depths of Near East Southern Swamp to bring you this man who, together with Joe Frank Hewlin, Jeff Nardone, and Jeff Schwab, was responsible for creating one of the earliest and most unique of doom metal bands, the one and only Goat Lord. Often derided at the time for their lack of polish and uniquely raw and aggressive yet lurchingly slow approach, there's been a well-deserved reevaluation in years since among aficionados of doom, black and thrash, and black metal for their dark, evocative horror atmosphere and lyricism. With both Goat Lord and his subsequent band Doom Snake Cult, this man is responsible for delivering some of the most sinister black metal style vocals ever recorded, crossing the borders of doom, black, and death metal years before any of those genres even came to exist. Please join us as we proudly present legendary vocalist and lyricist Ace Still of black and doom metal act Goat Lord and the slightly more experimental Doom Snake Cult, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll talk about the Vegas scene, the history of Goat Lord, and unravel the truth behind the longstanding myth of the erasure of Napalm Death's Mitch Harris from the Goat Lord album vocals. But before we get into that, here's the first song I ever heard from the band, and probably still their best-known track, a powerful evocation of midnight voodoo ritual deep in the southern swamp. Off the self-titled, or Reflection of the Solstice, depending on which version you own, this is Chicken Dance.
Thank you.
Tonight we're talking music, and we have with us the vocalist from not one, but two very unique and well-regarded bands from the early days of underground metal. Together with Jeff Nardone, Joe Frankulin, and Jeff Schwab, he was responsible for creating one of the earliest and most unique of doom metal bands, with more than a touch of death metal-style horror atmosphere and lyricism, and some of the most sinister black metal-style vocals ever recorded, years before any of those genres even came to exist. Often derided at the time for their lack of polish and uniquely raw and aggressive yet lurchingly slow approach, they developed a well-deserved reputation over the years among aficionados of doom, black and thrash, and black metal for the sheer eeriness and power of their sound. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to present the one and only Ace Still of Goat Lord and the slightly more experimental Doom Snake Cult. Ace, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Thank you. How you doing?
Tell us about Goat Lord. I discovered you when one of the DJs on our local underground metal station, WMSC, played Chicken Dance off your self-titled album around 1992. I couldn't believe it, even after having listened to bands like Possessed, Bathory, and Death for several years by that time. I'd never heard vocals that sinister. The feel was just like a horror movie set in a southern swamp. Seriously, I was seeing stuff like The Alligator People, you know, The Haunted Strangler, The Witchmaker, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, that kind of a feel. It's hard to describe because there isn't another band out there who really grasps it. Goat Lord revels in this sort of creepy, voodoo, swampy, New Orleans-style occult vibe akin to something like Exuma or the original Dr. John the Night Tripper album, but much darker. I can almost believe you guys were in some weird Lovecraftian voodoo cult. So how did you develop your sound? Who were your influences vocally and as a band?
You know, Chicken Dance is still regarded as, to us, as one of the more trippier of our songs. You know, that song actually came from, I wrote it after I watched Angel Heart with Mickey Rourke and the Voodoo Dance with Lisa Bonet in it. I mean, everybody remembers that.
Of course.
You can't. How can you forget it? The chicken's blood is so sweet. I actually got the name from that, from having chickens and stuff like that on farms. But I mean, with Goat Lord, I always took the lyrical approach from, I didn't want to be like anybody else and just sing about Satan and, you know, religion and stuff like that, although we did touch on those bases.
Right.
But the whole voodoo thing, we wanted to capture that weird imagery, you know. We wanted to make you feel like we were sitting in a swamp, sacrificing chickens and doing these voodoo rituals. We wanted to make it different and more pagan-like than just your satanic bullshit.
And it really worked, because, I mean, I know when that came out, I was like, who are these people? And you only had the one album out there and then vanished. It's like, oh, my God, is this really, you know, these guys for real?
Yeah, are they dancing naked and smearing chicken's blood on their chest? Which we, you know, some of our acid trips, we might have done that. I probably forgot about it, but that's what we were looking for.
So how did you develop your sound? Who were your influences?
Korthon was huge. You know, when we started, it was Sodom, the Destruction Sodom, Bathory, Tom Warrior.
Right.
Those were all big influences. But, I mean, I didn't really set out to sound like anybody or anything. You know, I wanted the lyrics to be enunciated. I wanted you to be able to understand them,
right.
You know, but it just kind of evolved into that, though. You know, you hear Sacrifice, the first one that was on the radio,
right?
And, you know, how low budget that was. And then it was never about quality. It was never, obviously, it was never about technique.
Right.
It was about being heavy, you know, and we wanted to be the heaviest band there was. But that sound I get, I guess, just came naturally.
Yeah,
you know, I didn't want it just to be a grunting, you know, I took influences, like I said, from Celtic Frost and Bathory. I'd say would be the two biggest influences.
Yeah, because it's crazy. I mean, even thinking about what was close, well, sort of Bathory, but not really. Morbid Angel, either with Mike Browning or with David Vincent, I'm like, no, not really. You know, this is something really different. I mean, you had a tonality there that I still haven't heard to this day with years of black metal behind me. So I just,
yeah, people used to compare me a lot to Killjoy from Necrophagian.
Right.
I didn't get that much into him. I didn't hear it, you know. I haven't heard anybody that sounds like me. Morbid Angel, I've heard that as well. But, you know, it's cool to be regarded as unique, that's for sure.
So let's go back to the beginning. You actually started out pretty early in 1985. There wasn't much of an underground that early on, particularly not out in Las Vegas. I mean, you had 7 Seconds, the punk band, but that's about it. So do you think your music is in any way impacted by or a reaction to being out in Vegas in particular? Because it's quite a shifty town for TV characters and hard luck types, drive-through weddings, a thriving prostitution racket, scam artists,
right.
And of course all the gambling. So do you think that impacts your music in any way?
I think being raised in Nevada, period, impacted our music. You know, we didn't have shit to do, you know. And when we did have shows and stuff, they were all, you know, desert shows with generators. There was a huge scene in Vegas. You know, I still don't think we ever became part of the scene in Vegas because we were so anti-everything.
Right.
We didn't want people wearing our shirts around or, you know, shit like, not that we had money to have them, but we were so anti-posing and anti-everything that, you know, it's still hard to believe to this day that we're still around.
Right.
We didn't, Vegas it kind of formed us. It was definitely meant to be. But Vegas does have its vices and stuff like that. And I guess that did have an influence on us.
And you're kind of alluding to these generator parties. I thought that only popped up around the time of, like, the early 90s, which I guess was around the same time as the album out. But, like, with Caius and bands like that, I wouldn't even picture you guys being part of that scene.
No, man, we bit Caius the punch by a long shot. We were desert metal. Vegas was desert before Caius came up. I hate to say it. I wouldn't want to argue with them about it, but Palm Desert is the same. But in the 80s, it was mostly punk in Vegas. It was all punk.
Right.
But, I mean, I can remember seeing COC, DRI, you know, bands like that at Keggers, burger parties out in the desert. You know, everything was desert.
They were probably coming out because of Kevin Seconds. He probably hauled them all out there.
Right. So, yeah, but there was a lot of good promoters there. You know, we had bands like Atomic God, Sean Sloan, you know, other bands that are still around right now, Fuck Shit Piss, Righteous Pigs, you know, Mitch from Napalm. I mean, all those bands were big promoters, and the circle there was big and still is.
So do you think Bugsy Siegel would be proud of what his little experiment became?
I actually think he would be. Yeah, Vegas is it's definitely not the same Vegas it was when I lived there, but yeah, Vegas is a good place.
Do you think the desert environment, with its extremes of heat and cold, with the hellish nature of the surroundings, the fact that a man could easily die out there from heat, dehydration, or rattlesnake bite, do you think that plays into the sort of music you were making and the sound you were reaching for?
In a way, you know, but I'd love to say, yeah, you know, Vegas is so hard to fucking live in and you're going to die if you go. I mean, yeah, the elements are bad there, definitely. Not just anybody can live in the fucking desert. No, that's the truth. But I think our music was forged more by our fucked up minds than anything else. You know, the shit we were listening to.
You guys actually put out 3 demos, all of which were eventually released on that Distorted Birth compilation. And in some ways, this is actually my favorite Goat Lord material. I prefer the rawness of it. The atmosphere is even darker and the pace is even slower in most cases. The production of the album, in terms of the instruments anyway, was too damn clean, if you can believe anybody saying that to you. So your 1987 demo, which later became known as Forever Black Dwell in Hell, the sound is really overdriven there. Was this recorded in one of your garages or basements on, like, a commercial-used tape recorder?
It was. Joe actually recorded that on a 4-track, and I think we did it in parts, if I remember correctly. You know, I can't remember, but I know it was on a 4-track, and it was just as low as you can get.
Yeah.
The sound of it, when we first heard that sound, I mean, nobody sounded like that, and that's exactly what we were looking for. We wanted it to sound like it was recorded in the basement in the bowels of hell.
Right.
You know, but
well, you definitely got that across.
Yeah, it was definitely low budget, but it was exactly what we were looking for. You know, the first time we heard it on the radio, we knew we were onto something.
Because I was listening to that, and I'm like, this has to be done in somebody's basement or garage or something, and they just pulled out their little tape recorder, Walkman or whatever, because it's so overblown. I mean, the power of it, you can hear the speakers can't really handle it. And it's too much for the device to take in. And if
it was
a studio, it must have been like the world's worst studio.
Oh, no, definitely wasn't a studio. You know, I can't remember the exact locale, but it was a garage, I'm pretty sure.
There's a lot of power and atmosphere to that material regardless. And if you had just done that demo and vanished, black metal kids would still have loved you, because look how much they love the Herod.
Yeah, the appeal of it is, I still don't know. I don't know what it is. The Fog, Sacrifice, you know, those songs. I guess it was just the simplicity, you know, but you have to be an outsider. You have to ask somebody that's not in the band what the appeal is. But there's sick people out there that love that the stuff like we do. You know,
hey,
the simplicity of it and the sheer heaviness of it, atmosphere.
So in 1988, you put out Sodomize the Goat, which, despite its silly title and the hand-drawn artwork, was a huge progression for you guys. Like I mentioned earlier, I tend to prefer this demo to what you did on the album in a lot of ways, because the guitars here are more raw and up front. The drums are a bit more buried in the mix and don't have that horrible electronic sound, which we'll get to in a minute. And your vocals, while they don't have the cavernous clarity they would later, are pretty well defined.
Yeah, Sodomize the Goat is our, that's it for me. I love that demo.
Yeah,
the re-release is awesome. The sound on that, I mean, I remember recording that. Joe, we did that, I think it might have been on the same 4-track. He did Worked His Magic. We actually did the lyrics in my apartment, and some lady called the cops because, you know, I lived in an apartment complex, and there was about 16 units, I think, we were upstairs, and, you know, I was belting this shit out, and the cops came pounding at the door, and we answered the door, and we didn't have any drugs, I don't think, any nothing lit at the time, and I answered the door, and the cops were standing there. They thought somebody was getting fucking murdered, man. True story. You know, you can imagine those lyrics being screamed and living next door to that. But, yeah, cops came, but it took a couple of days to do that. But when Joe finished it, I mean, it was just a monster. It was long. It's an hour long, I think. It's epic.
That's true.
You know, that was Goat Lord at its prime. Short-lived as we were, that was us.
That's a great story, too.
Yeah, there's a ton, but that was, yeah, that was pretty funny.
There's pluses and minuses as to which one is, quote, better compared to the album, but I find I pull that demo out, or at least the version on the Distorted Birth CD, more often than not when I want to hear some Goat Lord. And Acid Orgy in particular, but also The Fog, there's really no comparison between the versions you did there on Sodomize the Goat and the versions that wound up on the eventual album. It's like some of the energy and atmosphere was lost in the interim, and this is coming from a guy who's always loved that album, mind you. So did you feel that way, too? Did you feel like something was lost?
Lost when it finally hit the album. I feel a lot was lost on everything when it hit the album. From the electronic drums, you know, which, we'll, like you said, we'll get to. Yeah. But, I mean, Acid Orgy and everything on Distorted Birth was us in our prime.
Right.
I mean, everything, the atmosphere, the energy put into it, just everything was perfect on the album, I thought.
It's interesting. I mean, you agree on that.
Yeah, I mean, 100%.
So what was the deal with the two-song 1991 promo? Because that's definitely you on vocals, and the production's once again sort of improved. I guess Turbo Records commissioned studio time for this to see if they want to do the album?
There's no mistaking when it's me and when it's not, but as far as remixing them and all that, who knows who's got the fucking tapes now and the masters anymore?
Right.
You know, our shit's been passed around, so, you know, I don't know who signed off on what. You know, we're kind of getting back into a, you know, I talk to Jeff quite a lot. You know, Jeff and I have always been good friends. Joe, I talked to him once a couple of years ago, and Jeff's been kind of out of the mix, so we're kind of getting back, not together. I don't want to say that, but I'm getting to where I'll hear something if it happens now.
All the demos tend to share tracks. Like I've mentioned, Possessed Soldiers / Mutants of War, which I'll ask about in a second. And Underground Church wind up on all three of these demos, two demos in the promo. The Fog and Unholy Black Slut appear on the first two. I won't ask why the entire first demo was redone on the second one, since the recording quality was so off, but what happened to the tracks that never made it to either version of the eventual album, the lengthy Twilight Rem and the instrumental? And also, technically, Voodoo Mass was left off of your version of the album.
I don't know. I think Twilight Rem was just too fucking heavy, you know? Too long and too heavy. Twilight Rem is awesome.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know. There are songs that are popular. Those
right.
ones that I still wonder why the appeal of The Fog. And Unholy Black Slut's good, but there's just been some that have been picked. You know, I don't know if Joe picked those out every time or whoever did. But, yeah, there were definitely some that were overlooked. You know, the Voodoo Mass, the original version, was the best in my opinion. But it got reworked by Chris and,
right.
and I don't know.
Why the change from Possessed Mutants to Possessed Soldiers anyway?
Typo?
Typo.
Fuck. It was the lyrics. It was called Possessed Soldiers of War, and then they were mutants. And it's just one of those things, you know, things get changed lyrically in this, from one demo to the next.
Right.
It was never a conscious decision. You know, we got to go with Possessed Mutants. I know the song Possessed Soldiers of War, but then when it broke down in the middle, the lyrics said Possessed Mutants of War coming from their graves. So I think it was just after the war mutated them and they changed during the song is what I think happened.
I was just wondering if there's kind of rationale behind this, like, maybe we should change.
That was kind of it. They were soldiers, and then they were unearthed from their graves because they were mutants. Nuclear ship mutated them.
There's a number of things that need to be touched on at this point. First of all, you'd left Goat Lord between the demos and the band getting signed to an album deal. What happened there?
Doomsday Cults and nothing happened. I mean, Joe was strung out on doing whatever he was doing. I was, you know, doing what I was. Jeff got married, I think. You know, Goat Lord just dissolved kind of for a minute. You know, I was fucking bored, you know.
I hear that.
And we never practiced. I mean, we never practiced anyway. But then we just stopped practicing and everybody just kind of went their own ways. You know, we were all getting high and fucking around. And I've been a chef, you know, my whole life. But I mean, I've been cooking my whole life. So we all had jobs and stuff, you know. I didn't quit my day job to be a Goat Lord. And,
no.
You know, we just stopped playing and stopped practicing. Like, it was gone.
But then how did we end up with an album deal in the middle of that?
Joe was just Joe's the man. He was just constantly the driving force behind promoting us, I guess you'd say. You know, Joe would just always be putting out demos. He was the one that they were sending the demos to and back and forth and trading and, you know, get interviews and stuff like that. We'd do them, but, you know, I didn't do that. Joe did all that work.
Okay.
I did the easy part.
The second thing is, there were two versions of the album. It originally came out in the UK as Reflections of the Solstice with a line art cover of some guy in a goat pelt driving a chariot away from a sinister-looking castle on a moonlit night. And I understand it had been released with both colored and uncolored versions of that artwork. But since you weren't with them at this point, they had recruited Mitch Harris, the drummer with the more high-pitched, snarling backing vocals from Napalm Death, to handle vocal duties. But then you came back into the band, or however that worked, and the story was that you had managed to record your vocals right over Mitch's. So what happened? Was this reality, number one? And if it was it pure chance, or was it accidentally on purpose?
Well, that's the biggest fucking rumor there's ever been. Mitch and I, there was never any animosity.
Right.
When I was with Doomsnake Cult and we were doing shows in Vegas, Goat Lord wasn't doing anything, but we managed to get signed with Turbo, and they'd been playing with Mitch, which was cool because Mitch was, he had just joined Napalm, I think. So then they said, okay, we got a deal, we're doing an album, and Mitch just, his vocals just weren't cutting it. You know, it wasn't fucking, so they told me, and I said, yeah, I'll come down and sing. And, you know, which, and plus, I'm the rightful heir to that shit. You know, I wrote every fucking
right.
song on that, on every album there is. But as far as recording over anything, that's all bullshit. I mean, wherever that rumor came from, I mean, we still laugh at it. It was, no, they called me, I came down to the studio, everybody had their 40s, everybody had a bag of weed, some speed, walked in, what's up, Mitch, how you doing? It was exciting, I'd never been in a studio before. I was there, everybody was like, yeah, fuck yeah, Ace is here. You know, we started, played two tracks, you know, the chemistry was, you know, it was just like we just left off a few months before. I said, hey, let's do, double vocals on the Underground Church and
right.
Sacrifice, Acid Orgy, do this, you know. We just made it up in the studio. And I said, do the Acid Orgy, we'll overlap it. And yeah, it was all just, Mitch understood. Mitch had
right.
albums with Napalm. He knew, man, it was the right thing to do. And I wasn't crying about it. It just happened. So
right.
where the rumor ever came from, no idea.
Yeah, because that was,
you know,
actually
but, no,
well before the internet. I'd heard that rumor years ago. I mean, back around the time I had the album. I'm like, wow, there's some kind of Mitch Harris vocals that were floating around somewhere or aren't floating around, as the case may be.
Yeah.
And
I
was curious to hear what he would have did with it.
Yeah, I could almost guarantee that there's no Mitch Harris vocals floating around except for the ones on the album. And if there is, they would have surfaced by now. But yeah, it wasn't like that. It was like, show up at the studio, what up, dude, and just...
Right.
This is the mic. Let's lay down some tracks. Let's have some fun with it.
But like you said, I do think that your vocals really make the album and the Goat Lord sound per se. It was definitely the right choice in the end. Now, after you recorded your vocals here, I guess you left again?
It wasn't like, you know, I want to make this clear. It wasn't like I left again, you know.
Right.
We weren't fucking married or anything. I didn't travel, you know, a million miles, you know. They said, hey, the studio's over on Rancho. Come by. We'll fucking smoke some joints and do the album. We did the album. I didn't leave. I was 2 miles away from any member of the band at any given time, a phone call away. They weren't practicing either, you know? Nobody was... Goat Lord wasn't doing anything,
okay.
You know? And Doomsnake Cult was.
That's where
Doomsnake
I got to
was,
play all the stuff up.
Yeah. Doomsnake Cult was jamming. We were playing, you know, we were playing some good gigs. And my heart was with Doomsnake Cult at that time.
Right.
You know? I thought, you know, the doomier side of it, and it was more... It was had more of a... I don't want to say hippie vibe to
yeah,
it, but it was more.
What you're talking about.
It was a different. It was a different scene, and it was new and fresh.
Right.
You know, that was it.
Just trying to get to the end of Goat Lord. The band apparently was dissatisfied with the recording of Reflections and wound up remastering and re-recording at least some instruments on it for another version of the album that was marketed here to test in the U.S. simply titled Goat Lord. Now, the Goat Lord version of the album is the one I have with a nicer cover, the guy on the tree under the full moon. There's a lot of reverb and a dash of delay on your vocals, and I really like that aspect of it. But one thing that always stood out, and not in a good sense, is those electronic drums Jeff was playing. A lot of people over the years had claimed that there was no drummer, that it was just a drum machine or something, but so far as I know and can tell, that's not true. It's still Jeff. But what was the story here?
We were high. Jeff... We were in the studio. We were all young. Jeff got, you know, jumped on some electronic drums. Somebody made the suggestion, not me, nobody in the band, that, you know, yeah, man, they sound good, you know, and that was it. You know, I don't know if it was Mitch. I don't know if it was Brett or whoever recorded the first one. It sounded good in the studio, like on one song. But as far as switching for the whole album, you know,
right.
What a fucking shame, you know. It really is.
I mean,
I can barely listen to the shit. You know, I've never been able to get past it. I really haven't.
Because I can't. I can listen past it, but it's noticeable. I mean, it's like, geez.
It's not. It is Jeff, for sure.
Right.
He's playing all that. You know, and Jeff, he gets a bad rap for that. But, yeah, it's, what a shame. You know, Goat Lord with electronic drums. It just doesn't seem, it's like fucking blasphemy. You know? I don't know why we didn't talk him out of it, or I don't know if I wasn't there or what. But
right.
it just kind of happened, and then they ended up, and... We just all went, holy fuck, what'd we do?
And also, like I said earlier, it's a bit too clean and polished on the instrument end of the equation, particularly by comparison with the demo versions. You know, this isn't the sort of music that you want a crisp attack on, really. It's muddy and swampy. You really want something closer to a more produced version of the second demo, or maybe even the last Sodomy sections, tonally speaking. What was the deal with, you had had the one version that they recorded over in England, and then they came over here and re-recorded some of the instruments. So what did they re-record?
No idea, honestly. As far as the instruments, I don't think they re-recorded anything.
Really?
I don't think so. You know, I know they remixed it. Is that
that could be.
Yeah,
I know
that.
Re-recorded some stuff.
I'm pretty sure they never went back in the studio and re-recorded anything.
So you just weren't happy with the sound on it, and you tried to master it differently.
They did. Yeah, so, that was a different mixologist, I think, and they tried to make it totally different because they weren't happy with the version. But yeah, I don't think anything got re-recorded.
There's one other bit of business that rubs oddly. They brought in Chris Gannis to record Voodoo Mass, which is one of the few demo tracks that didn't make it to Reflections. And then they put that track first in the running order. You know, a lot of time I was sitting there wondering why you didn't put in as good a vocal performance on that particular track until I noticed that credit. So the album actually starts off on the wrong foot with a less, less special performance coming first. So why was this track left off of the original recordings of Reflections and Solstice in the first place?
Voodoo Mass left off Reflections. I couldn't tell you. I mean, Voodoo Mass was one of my favorite songs. You know, I don't know. I don't want to say that it could have been in the band, Petty Bullshit Band Fighting, you know, why it was Joe put it first. You know, that wasn't my decision.
No, I know that. But I'm saying, in the first place, the part that you were involved with, which is when you recorded this thing over in England, why wasn't it there in the first place? Because, okay, they say, well, he's not here now. We're going to put it on with this other guy, and we're going to throw it on first. You had nothing to do with that. But why wasn't it there when you recorded it originally? It's actually one of the few tracks that was left off of your demo.
Yeah, I don't know. Can't give you a better answer than that.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Ace Still of Goat Lord and Doom Snake Cult. Coming up next, we talk Doom Snake Cult, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
This is Adam from Tribulation, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is James Murphy, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Rick Ross from Massacre, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Brian Lawrence from Dream Death, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
In our next segment, we talk Doom Snake Cult, playing from the heart and making music that lasts, and some advice for up-and-coming bands, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, we pay a visit to another dark ritual we probably shouldn't be privy to. Off the self-titled, it's time to enter the underground church.
Oh.
So at this point, Goatlord went on with Chris Gans to record the rehearsal sessions for a second album that never happened, but which eventually got released as The Last Sodom and Mary. Even Jeff took a turn on vocals with Catawba, and you were there on one special track. But at this point, you'd left Goatlord for the second time, or you know, walked away, or whatever it was, to join Doom Snake Cult. And they had put out a demo in 1989. You weren't on that. You had joined after recording those vocals for Reflections, and were there on the band's 1992 album, Love, Sorrow, Doom. So how did this come about?
Well, I knew I grew up with Paul, the bassist, who's now with Jeff, and Glenn and Raj. I mean, we all lived together in a town called Pahrump, Nevada, outside of Vegas.
Right.
You know, we'd known each other since sixth grade and shit.
Wow.
So we were all just into the heavy stuff. And when Goatlord kind of was spinning out, Glenn had put out that Doom Snake Cult, the first one.
Right.
And he had sung on that. And it just kind of, it just happened, you know. They were more into the slower, the Vitus, the Pentagram, and acid and all the hallucinogenics. So we kind of, it just was a natural, it was the evolution of me, really, to join that band. But we'd all been tight, and it started as friends, because we'd all jam together. We'd hang out together. Somebody always had a guitar and some drums, and basically just we'd be partying and playing, but then Doom Snake Cult became reality. You know, we realized that we had something.
Yeah, because in some ways it was like a linear progression from Goatlord to Doom Snake Cult, but there were some real changes in feel and focus tossed into the mix, because you know, Doom is a strange lyrical conflation about loving your fellow man that winds up going on about World War II. I'm not sure if it's for contrast or what you were trying to get at there.
I think, you know, love was written, you know, a lot of the songs had already been written when I got in the band. Sorrow I wrote, Carnival Freak Show we wrote together. Love had already been written, but love was about love, man. I mean, like I said, I'm not kidding you when I said we ate a lot of acid and we were going through our hippie stage.
Right.
You know, it was just all about, we thought, we didn't want to sing about Satan, really. It was more about, you know, the more psychedelic side, trippier lyrics.
You got this whole song going on about, you know, I love everybody and whatever. And all of a sudden you start talking about Hitler and Mussolini. I'm like, wait a minute, is this supposed to be by contrast or like what's going on here? So what do you guys
that was,
get at with that?
Who the fuck knows, man? I mean, I think in the studio, what is it, Hitler, Amin, and Mussolini,
right,
all live together in harmony, nations of war, nations of peace, nations of war, kill fellow man, greed takes over.
Right.
I think it was just some ad-libbed lyrics that talked about some powerful leaders
right. That
fucked everything up.
Right. I figured it was for contrast, but I wasn't sure because it was like, I listened to it a couple times straight, and I'm like, wait a minute, are they saying what I think? I'm not really... I couldn't put my finger on it.
Yeah, I think it was just a contrast of love and what hate can do.
So then you have Carnival Freak Show, which you'd mentioned, which, while it sets up a creepy atmosphere, it seems to show some real empathy towards the outsider, rather than just being a scary horror movie sort of thing like The Fog or Blood Month. You keep saying how the freaks are at peace with themselves and they aren't hurting or bothering anybody. Where'd you get this approach from? What was this about?
That I actually was just talking to somebody about the other day. Raj and I, Big Raj, the drummer, I'd gone to a place called Calamity Jane's, which is a club in Vegas, to nurse some wicked hangovers one morning, and Freaks, the old movie, was on the big screen, you know, behind the bar. It was about 10, I think, in the morning. Well, I think we were the only people in there. Anyway, Freaks was behind the bar. There was no sound. But I wrote those lyrics on a napkin, bar napkin, while we were sitting there drinking Bloody Marys. And it was from the outsider, my view of looking at the Freaks. Once again, it kind of had a, I don't want to say peaceful tone to it, but I was in that hippie stage, you know. I was like,
yeah,
hey man, the freaks are just they're just the freaks, you know? Leave the freaks alone, but then you fucked with the freaks, and now you're going to pay the fucking price, you know?
That's kind of what I picked up, though. I was like, this is interesting that you're getting a band, especially one that was that heavy, singing these kind of trippy, you know, hey, man, it's cool, you know? Those kind of lyrics where you're showing empathy for other people and talking about love, and it's really, Doom Snakehole is a really unique band in that respect.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what, and we knew that. We knew that, once again, it wasn't about high musicianship or anything like that. It was about being unique. And we knew that we could walk around or not. There were so many other bands in Vegas doing the Exodus, doing the Metallica or the this band, that band thing. And we wanted to always be different. And it wasn't hard to do because that was really who we were at that time.
Right.
You know, I was had a few girlfriends, you know, always had a bag of weed, always had some mushrooms. We were...
That's it, you're happy.
Yeah, we were happy. I mean, we were always at, you know, blues festivals. We'd go to a blues festival or we'd be listening to, you know, fucking Cat Stevens. But we were still... at heart, all about death and doom. But, you know, there's another aspect to music that Doom Snake Cult embraced besides just sheer satanic heaviness.
And you had mentioned that you penned Sorrow. I already kind of picked that up because Sorrow sounds a lot like a Goat Lord track lyrically. And it even has some of that same swampy feel to it.
That was the last song, I think, that we did, that we wrote together. And I don't know, to me, it really doesn't have any kind of Goat Lord feel to it.
You don't think so, lyrically?
No, it talks about acid and getting on the ark and leaving this world for another. I think it's still got that hippie sensibility, expanding the mind. I don't see the Goat Lord connection.
What the two bands do have in common beyond your vocals, which are more along the lines of what would eventually become Blackmail, is a sense of outsideness, a very unique approach that falls somewhere between doom metal, thrash, and early death and black metal. Both bands have the slower pace of doom for the most part, that sort of bleak Sabbath feel. And yet, there's a lot of death metal style horror in there, plus a fair amount of the occult focus, and again, your vocal approach. At the time, there was really only a few bands that were sounding like that at all. I mean, you had Bathory, you had Early Sepultura, you had Sarcophago, maybe Volcano. But none of them approached that dark, weirdly sepulchral tonality you were getting into, particularly with all that cavernous reverb that really both bands had tapped into. But of course, back in the mid to late 80s, early 90s, all the underground stuff kind of blurred boundaries and crossed genres. Most of the subgenres that started getting defined in the 90s to today, that was more posthumous. People just putting this stuff in as a box as more bands came around and started to sound like this group or that one. It was scenes being built around what were originally just strange echoes from the void. Most bands were reasonably unique and specific in their own sound, and you couldn't really say one band sounded just like another. I also understand that Glenn from Doom Snake Cult and the guys from Goat Lord were friends, which you had actually mentioned prior to your change of bands, because Glenn played with you and Jeff on that Slade Necros track from the radio show that appeared on Goat Lord's Last Sodomy of Mary compilation. Tell us about that.
Wow. Do you know the whole story behind that? I mean, that was recorded. I mean, that was just one of those days where we were at the pool, doing nothing, listening to the new, you know, Possess or Hellhammer. I forget what came out. And Glenn, that was actually recorded on a Mr. Microphone. You know what that is? That was recorded on a Mr. Microphone, I think, or something to that equivalent. And I think Jeff had a tin pan or something that he used as a bass drum and a fucking spoon. And I mean, that was just like a jam. And Glenn played acoustic on the guitar is acoustic. I think it was on the top string of a 4-string guitar. Yeah, I mean, that just came out, and that sound, the vocal sound, came right out of his stereo.
Wow.
That was plugged into the front of an old stereo, and then it came out like that. Literally.
But you actually were on a radio station talking to some guy with this stuff.
Yeah. You mean about this song?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of little interviews back then. They had some radio shows in Vegas that they played, you know, all of Sodomize the Goat a few times, and we did some stuff, but it was a long fucking time ago, so.
Because when they put it on the compilation, you actually get the radio show part, and then it goes into the song, and I was like, wow, this must have been really surreal.
Yeah, hearing that song, you know, the Slade Necros was just, but that was the Record Gallery, it was called, and Barry Shabansky was the owner of it. You know, that's where we got everything metal.
Right.
You know, Vegas had this one spot. I can remember getting Hell Awaits right out of the box. I can remember getting the first Trouble right out of the box. You know, Barry would turn us on to this stuff, and it was game on.
Nice.
I mean, that's before we'd even heard stuff. We would see the cover of it, and, oh, holy fuck, you know, when Venom was scary.
Right.
You know, back in the early 80s, he had black metal, and holy fuck, man, I don't know if I could buy that. But then Warren Payne came out and Morbid Tales, stuff like that. So it's game on after that.
Now, the band being Doom Snake Cult obviously named themselves after False Doom Snake Cult from the John Milius Conan movie from 1981. And I also found this movie very profound and affecting when I saw it in theaters as a child. But it doesn't seem to come across in any way in the music. You don't seem to be tapping into Robert E. Howard's stories, his mythos, or his themes in any real way. There's more of a mix, it's like Goat Lord, of like horror cult themes with a love of LSD. So what was that all about? You know, wouldn't it give you a particularly bad trip thinking about the sort of topics you were touching on and building the sort of atmosphere you do with both bands while dropping tabs? Because I keep hearing, don't take the brown acid.
Right. You know, yeah, no. I mean, it's not like we purposely set out and dropped acid to have bad trips. But, yeah, I mean, I guess you could definitely have some bad, you know, there's the potential of having a bad trip while listening to our music, that's for sure. You know, the drugs, you know, I don't know if they fueled us like they did, you know, some bands in the 60s, you know, Expand Your Mind, this and that. But, I mean, hey, I don't know. Drugs are more of a pastime, but they definitely had a play in some of the lyrics, for sure.
You've definitely got a more introspective vibe here, because while you have tracks like Tribal Seance, things like that, that clearly harken back to the older horror, the external horror of Goat Lord, you have a lot of songs that touch on more internal states, you know, the unconscious, losing yourself, looking into the mirror and seeing your void, beyond the locked gates of your cerebellum, swimming in the ocean of ideas, leaving this world for another. I mean, Enchanted Cerebral Forest and Fertility right alone. You're really going out there. Was this all just from tripping, or did you have something else going on that led you into all this?
Well, Glenn wrote the lyrics to Enchanted Cerebral Forest, and Glenn's just, he's all fucked up. So his lyrics were, when I saw those lyrics and had to put them to a Death Doom song, I said, holy fuck, this is a mouthful. But it was awesome because from the opening, the vibe, the guitar and everything, it takes you into kind of a trancey kind of state, and it is the lock gate to your cerebellum. It's just, you know, acid is the key, and it just launches. It was just this whole, it felt like a journey. That's kind of what we were looking for.
So what was with all the pseudonyms in Doom Snake Cult? I know you and Glenn Bonner, who went by Nell, which was his name first, but what was the deal with Gore, which I'm guessing he was a Roger, especially since you had mentioned that earlier, and Schwabi,
right,
who I'm guessing is Jeff Schwab from Goat Lord? You don't generally get pseudonyms outside of black metal. At the time you were doing this stuff, there was probably only King Diamond, Quorthon, Hellhammer, and Venom who were going by anything other than their real name, or at least a real-sounding stage name, like Vinnie Vincent. So where did that come from?
Glenn. But those were our nicknames. Glenn went by Nell because, you know, once again, he was Glenn. He was like, man, I'm going by fucking Nell, dude. You know, it sounded, it had this Viking-type warrior tone to it.
Right.
You know, anybody could put, once again, it was a unique thing. You know, anybody can put Glenn on an album, but Nell, you just reversed it, and it stuck. Gore, we used to call Rog Newful Gore before that. Rog, his name's Rog LaFoon, but his name was always Big Newf. You know, Newful Gore. It just fit, and it sounded cool.
Right.
I didn't need one because my name was Ace, and you can't get much cooler than Ace.
Right.
You know, that's what they said, and Schwabi was Schwabi.
Now, there's another crossover between Goat Lord and Doom Snake Cult, and that's how Paul Brady, who used to be in Doom Snake Cult, is now playing with Jeff Nardone of Goat Lord and his new death metal act, Spun in Darkness. So do you guys all still see each other, since it seems like there's such a tightly weaved web of fate connecting you all?
I haven't seen Paul in probably 3, 4, 5 years. I see Jeff, saw him a couple times last year. We just went and saw Pentagram last year. Jeff and I have gotten back pretty close, but, you know, we get older, everybody does their own thing. You know, Paul is kind of, haven't talked to Paul in a while. As far as Goat Lord, you know, Schwabi, I've talked to him, chatted with him on Facebook a few times. Raj, I talked to him a few months back up in Reno from Doomsnake. I saw Glenn at Pentagram. So it's weird because all of us are always going to be tight, you know, but you live in different states. You know, it's hard to keep in contact.
So what sort of place do you see Goat Lord and later Doom Snake Cult as occupying in the metal scene of their day? Because at the time, bands like Sodom, Creator, and Bathory, who were possibly revered today, were looked down upon for being sloppy or not knowing how to play their instruments. Bands like Sepultura, Sacrifice, Destruction, and Death kept evolving out of fear that they'd be seen the same way and tended to downplay or even put down the earlier material. And yet, the material that stands the test of time, the albums that I go back to and have gone back to over and over for all these years, are those first albums from those same bands. So where do you see your two bands?
On the outside, looking in. We didn't want to be, you know, I listened to the first Bathory the other day, and I was talking to Jeff, and we wanted to be as low budget as fucking possible. We didn't want to sound like shit, but we wanted it to be real. You know, we wanted it to be real. We want them to be real. All those bands that, so many bands are, have their first one and they don't like the sound of it, and then they go, they overproduce. I mean, we did it on our album. You know, they get overproduced. They get try to get technical. They think they're going to do all these great things. We never, you know, granted, if I would have known that we'd still be talking, I'd be doing an interview about Goat Lord 20 years, 25 years down the line,
right,
we might have taken it a little more seriously, you know, but it is what it is, you know, in this world, whatever God you believe in charge of everything. So, you know, it happened the way it happened. I'd rather be known for some underproduced, shitty quality sounding demos and some overproduced bullshit that just got thrown into the, that's on sale for 99 cents in the, at the record store right now.
Thank you. That's how I feel. Because I was going to say.
Yeah, no, we're known for some real shit, man, that makes people think and that carved out a chunk out of people that, that is still exists today. You know, you can listen to Sepultura's 8th album, I mean, whichever one, just saying, who the fuck's got that or who remembers it?
Right.
You know? You remember our shit.
Exactly. And then you go back and listen to Morbid Visions, and that's the one you remember. Like, who gives a shit what they did after that?
Yeah, Morbid Angel, I mean, the first couple of tapes that Joe got, but when we tape traded, you know, that's how we got started in all this shit. All the demo tapes,
right,
those were the real heavy shit. That's the shit you go back to and listen to.
Exactly.
You know?
I always thought, along the same lines, that Goat Lord was unjustly put down for its rawness and simplicity of form. I really fail to see how you could have possibly built the sort of atmosphere you did with a busier, more articulate arrangement, you know, with somebody like Yngwie on guitar and somebody like Scott Travis on drums. It just doesn't happen. It's more of like a naive art sort of a thing. So do you feel that Goat Lord and or Doomsnake Cult have been any sort of an influence on bands who came up in their wake, or is this more of an isolated, unique phenomenon for all these years?
Well, there's bands like, look how many Goat Lord. I mean, Goat Lord started the whole goat metal. We were the first band to use goat in the name. We were the first band to put the goat symbolism. It was just like right there, you know. Why somebody didn't think of it before, I have no idea. But, yeah, we've been a huge influence. You know, but nobody can, you can't be Goat Lord if you're an amazing musician.
Right.
You know, Goat Lord came from the fucking heart.
Right.
You know, those lyrics came from the heart. That music came from the heart. We played as good as we could. We didn't try to play shittier. I mean, we were just, Jeff was just not that great of a drummer at that time. You know, Jeff evolved over time. Joe was simple. We were simplistic. We were simple people. We had day jobs. We didn't, you know, sit in the studio, jam every fucking day, 3 hours a day to be awesome and then fail miserably. We gave it about 75% and we achieved what we wanted. We accomplished it.
Exactly.
You know, we made the heaviest shit ever and it touched people. You know, and that's what we wanted to do.
That's actually the focus of the show, whether I'm talking about movies or whether I'm talking to musicians. I've always said this to people that I don't care about the crap that Hollywood's putting out. You don't give me a big budget and something that's super produced and, you know, got top tier stars. Chances are it's going to suck and I'm not going to remember it or care about it. It's like a waste of my time. But you give me something that's, like I said, naive art. Somebody that's like a 14-year-old kid goes and plays his first band. It could be great. You don't know. And maybe that stuff will be remembered, you know, 20, 25 years down the road. Because that's what you're looking for. You're looking for the stuff that's just going to come out naturally from, you know, whatever influences somebody had. And they filter it and then they just do what they got to do. They're not sitting there like repeating blues licks that they learned from whoever, you know, B.B. King.
It's not some homogenized bullshit. We didn't listen to shit, even though we loved Bathory, we loved Hellhammer. We didn't copy anybody and we didn't set out to do anything, but our sound became our sound from starting face to face in a garage or in a room and pounding out these songs. You know, our sound just was spawned. You know, it just happened. You can't make that shit up.
So where has life taken you since the days of Goat Lord and Doomsnake Cult? Are you still involved in music at all, or has, quote, normal life taken hold?
I wouldn't call my life normal at all, but still a huge fan of music. I'm not in a band. I've got some friends that have bands here in Phoenix. I go to see a lot of live shows. Jeff said, come down and sing with us a few times. But, you know, as of the moment, it's been 20-something years. But normal life hasn't taken over, but I'm not jamming as we speak.
So do you have anything you'd like to plug? Do you have a website or Facebook, anything like that you want to point listeners to?
No, nothing. I would say just support Spun in Darkness. Jeff has got a good thing going there. I mean, they're true old school death metal, and I just think they deserve some fans.
Sure.
Other than that, I would just support Doom and the Underground.
Any words of wisdom to share with young bands coming up today with a basement and a vision?
I would say, you know, do what your heart says. Go with your heart. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be fucking like that great band across the street or anything like that. I mean, it needs to be from the gut. You know, that's the shit that resounds with people. Whether it's black metal, whether it's blues metal, whether it's fucking good old rock and roll. I mean, whatever it is, people latch on to and remember things that are real.
All right, totally agreed. Well,
and it doesn't help to have a priest sodomizing a goat on the cover as well. That kind of sticks with people too. So.
Well, with that, Ace, I'd like to thank you again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and you know, all the best to you.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, metal forever.
And to close out our interview with Ace, we have what is by far my favorite track off the Sodomize the Goat demo, a surprisingly superior version to the one that appeared in the album proper. Stay tuned after the close for one more track from Goat Lord, but first it's time to join the Acid Orgy. Thank you.
Eric Higgins from Venomous Maximus talking on Third Eye Cinema. You haven't seen anything yet.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Ace Hill. Next time on Week 60 of Third Eye Cinema, good old boy Greg Higgins of Texas Central Filmsters, Venomous Maximus. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or filmmaker, musician would like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network. Sodomized the Goat demo. It's time to get lost in the fog. balance the equation, here's one last song. This one's coming from Ace's other band, Doom Snake Cult. This is Carnival Freak Show. If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. And remember, next week...
This is Greg Higgins from Venomous Maximus talking on Third Eye Cinema. You haven't seen anything yet.